So thank you for the introduction, and thank you for the invitation to speak here today. Very, very much looking forward to an interesting discussion. That's not my slide. This is my slide. The topic we're going to cover today is exascale computing for research and the implications of quantum computing, AI, and net zero. And as you'll have seen in the announcement of the event, it's about looking at one of the questions we want to look at is how have things changed in terms of what we need from computing, given the net zero requirements, and particularly now AI and quantum computing. So in these opening statements, we're just going to give some thoughts about various aspects of that. So the large-scale computing is a key requirement now for, and it underpins research in pretty much every area. So that's scientific research, it's the same in industry, it's in academia, it's in government and the public sector. So everywhere large-scale computing is a key requirement. And it's actually, we should think of these large-scale computers as research instruments. So they're not just laptops, they're actually instruments that are carrying out and are essential for the research process. The challenge, of course, then is that research doesn't stay still. And so there's a constant process of changing what research we're doing, the questions we want to answer, and that means we have to refine the tools that we're using. And the tools include hardware and software. So there are many reasons why the research questions drive changes in the compute requirements. One is you might need increased resolution. You want to do calculations that you can already do, but do them with greater fidelity. You may actually need to include new processes in the discussion. So it may be that there's new physics, or in a social sciences problem, you may need to consider different types of actor. You may be coupling with different models, so taking models from at different scales. So on a weather model, you might be looking at small scale effects and things to do with the ocean temperatures, as well as large scale and effects. And you need to merge these different things together. And a key thing now is uncertainty quantification. What you want to come out at the end is actionable outcomes, so information that you can actually use to make decisions. And for that, you have to have uncertainties associated with them. All of these things mean that you end up needing more computational resources. No matter how efficient you are, the bigger the question, you always end up requiring more compute. And so what I'll explain is how an outcome-driven, so focusing on what you want to get out of the system, co-design approach to defining the ecosystem we want to end up with, that can give you a balanced set of services, and it allows those services to evolve as the research environment evolves. And so one example of that is the TIRSA GPU-based system, which is part of the Dirac facility. So it's here, based here at Edinburgh. So it was designed for particle physics theory research, but actually when large language models suddenly became a thing, it turned out it was ideally suited to training large language models. And so that's a case where having an ecosystem of services means you can then use them as the research environment evolves. And actually the first LLM to be trained entirely on UK-based compute was trained on the TIRSA system, which is at the ACF, the Advanced Computing Facility that EPCC run. So what are the components then of a productive ecosystem? So a key thing is people. You need people to design the systems, build the systems, run the systems, write the software, and do the research. And so people, the people aspect is often overlooked, but they are absolutely critical, and it's something that the UK has a great strength in. Software is obviously vital as well. It's software that allows researchers to make use of whatever resources there are available, and it determines how efficiently we can use the systems. Hardware obviously underpins all of it. If you don't have a computer, you can't use a computer. So we do have to have investment in all of these. The critical thing is data. So everything, the value of the outputs all comes down to the data. The data contains the information, the insights, and everything that comes out of the research process. And so that really has to be at the heart of how we think of the ecosystem. But all of these aspects do need investment, unfortunately. So I will be mentioning the question we were told not to mention. There is a need for investment. So what's large-scale computing useful for? So But this audience, you'll all be familiar. There are many different ways it can be used. It's essentially delivering research and innovation, but across industry, academia, and government. So every area, as I said, is able to make use of it. I've just given some examples on this slide, but this is by no means, we'll hear more examples in the next two talks. It's by no means comprehensive. But the ones I've got here are things like changing how we do prototyping of new things within engineering. So if you want to build a nuclear fusion plant, they're going to have to be built as simulations first, and then they will be built. There's not going to be another prototype before the systems are deployed. So that's a complete paradigm shift in how we will be doing design of systems in the future. Personalized medicine, so being able to run a simulation of an individual human. This isn't an AI-based thing, it's actually being able to run a simulation of an individual and say, how will this individual's body react to a particular medicine? That is still years away, but there's work being done. It requires exascale computing to do that kind of calculation. Fundamental science, so the Dirac facility that I'm the director of supports research in particle physics, nuclear physics, astrophysics, and cosmology. And so in all of those areas, large-scale computing is absolutely essential. But now with AI coming on board, so there, you want to be able to run very large models, train very large models on new data in real time. So while an event is happening, whether that's a natural disaster, a social event, or an economic situation, you want to be able to feed in the new data, retrain the model, and get information that you can make decisions on, you can use to make decisions, and you need that in real time. And so you can test scenarios when you're in using large-scale computing. The other thing that can help in a government context is to be able to bring together all the relevant data from many different sources, whether it's simulation data, detector data, survey data, put it all together and train your models much more comprehensively. And again, that can be used to deliver concrete outcomes that can then be decisions can be based on. And another use of computing in the context of AI is actually to generate data that can be used to train the models and help to make them more robust to the risks of the model training data being poisoned, either accidentally or deliberately. So that's large-scale computing, and so exascale is a key component of that. The complementary technologies, couch the AI and quantum in those terms, because these are things that where it's part of the whole ecosystem of doing research. And again, large-scale computing supports all of these, but also these have their own independent use cases as well, obviously. So with AI, obviously it runs on large-scale computing. So the two, AI and computing, are not distinct. Their AI is something that uses large computing. Quantum computing, you still need large-scale classical computers to do the error corrections for quantum computers. And that actually, I've mentioned there about co-location of systems, that has implications for how we design the ecosystem around the UK, because if every quantum computer needs to have a large supercomputer beside it, we'd need to include that in the planning. Secure computing and urgent computing. So secure computing, particularly for government and industry, that is an increasingly important area, but it's also something that is now possible. You can take a system and use a software-defined approach to break it up into pieces so that you can have a government department and an industry partner and academic researchers all on the same system, each of them having different security levels in terms of accessing what data they're using or generating. And I've mentioned already the value of having urgent computing, being able to use systems and get useful information quickly. All of those opportunities that can be used in terms of how we can use computing, obviously there are also the corresponding threats. In the wrong hands, either from criminal activity or state-sponsored malicious actors, all of there are threats that we need to be aware of. The kind of summary of how to I would think about it is everything that can be done now, the threat becomes much worse if it could be done 1,000 times more frequently or at 1,000 times the level of sophistication. And that's the kind of change from having, let's say, a criminal organization that can access a petaflop of compute versus a criminal organization that can access an exaflop. Now, an exaflop system is hard to hide, so criminals are probably limited in terms of how much they can get access to, but state-sponsored systems are certainly a risk. And what the UK needs is to be able to counter those threats. So that means having a serious computational ecosystem so that they can that we can fight against them, because you can't mitigate those kind of threats. And I've listed some there, but they include things like having the development of deep fakes, so you get a video call from a colleague asking you a piece of information, and it's so realistic that you just, even if you're a spy, you trust that it's because it's come in on a secure link. And so there are they are becoming much more sophisticated, and now the whole criminal process is being run using AI. So given all of those benefits, requirements, different use cases, how can we actually take account of that in a way that actually delivers something concrete? So this is what the co-design process that I mentioned earlier essentially starts from, what the use cases are. So you need to engage with all the people who will use the services and work out what it is they're trying to do. So that's the output-driven part, and that involves that those use cases will come from government, industry, academia, or wherever. Then you look at those and say, well, what does that actually mean in terms of the things people are doing? What workflows are they actually going to need to run? And that leads to a technical case. So that gives you a high level, how many services you might need, what they should generally look like. Then you can take those and turn them into technical designs by working with the computing industry. And there's been some great successes of this in the UK. And so one example, again, since we're in Edinburgh, to emphasize the success of the TIRSA system. So there was a six-month co-design process in the deployment phase of that system, during which the performance doubled for the workflows that it was supporting. So that is doubling the return on investment. In this case, it was science output, but whatever however you define the return, it was doubled. And that was through a combination of the researchers who were working on it, research software engineers from DIRAC, the technical team at the ACF in EPCC, and the technical team from Atos, who was the provider. All of them working together delivered huge benefits. So going via a co-design process can lead to increased outputs, however you define, whatever those outputs are that you're looking for. It also has a net zero benefit, because it does, if you're able to use the hardware more efficiently, it doesn't necessarily mean your carbon footprint goes down, but your carbon footprint per unit of output goes down. And so that's a good reason for taking a co-design approach as well. As I say, DIRAC isn't the only example of this. There's Iris, Jasmine, GridPP. There are many examples across the UK of this. There's a lot of expertise in how to do this. And sorry, yeah. And so the final slide, spoiler alert, you now know who's next. So what do we need to do? So I think we're in a very good position in terms of having all the groundwork in place. We have, we can move from a good starting point, but there's no way to get around the first bullet. We need investment. So we need to invest in an output defined computing system. It needs to cover all of the stakeholders that I mentioned. So not just academia, it needs to include industry, public sector, and government. We are good in the UK at computing above the flops that we on paper have. We've got a really skilled community in the UK. We have very extensive training programs to produce more, to increase the size of that community. There has been support for software development through Excalibur, but that has now ended, and that needs to be continued. And we have world-leading SMEs who are able to do working in the software-defined space. So there's all the groundwork is there. But if we have the investment, the risk is if we don't have the investment, a lot of this could disappear. And if it does, it's very hard to rebuild it again because of the loss of confidence. The final thing is just to say, we also need to continue to collaborate internationally. So EPCC has been leading on that, and Hartree in terms of European and other countries. The key point is we've got to use the language of the AI action plan. We've got to be makers in this space, not just takers. If our only engagement with international partners is to say, can I use your computer because I don't have one, that's not a sustainable way forward. But I think right now, with sufficient investment, I think it's a really exciting opportunity, and we could do an awful lot in the next few years with the right investment to go with it. So thank you.